Thank you, Your Honor. Barbara Furutani for the claimant, registration number 13767. Three issues have been raised in this case, but the most important issue is the issue of whether the claimant's average weekly wage must be recalculated to include the cost of all health and dental insurance, regardless of when the employer seeks payment of benefit. The statute is absolutely clear on this issue. I realize that ICAP and the ALJ don't agree with me, but I think the statute is pretty clear. If we go to CRS section 840.201.19(a)(b), the legislature stated that wages shall be construed to mean the money rate at which the service rendered recompense under the contract of hire enforced at the time of injury, either express or implied. That's A. B then says, the term wages includes the amount of the employee's cost of continuing the employer's group health insurance plan, and upon termination of the continuation, the employee's cost of conversion to a similar lesser insurance plan. If after the injury, the employer continues to pay any advantage of fringe benefits specifically enumerated, including the cost of health insurance coverage or the cost of conversion of health insurance coverage, that advantage or benefit shall not be included in the determination of employee wages so long as the employer continues to make payment. Now, in this particular case, the claimant had health insurance that was 100% paid for by his employer at the time he was injured. He was injured in August of 2007. He stopped working for his employer in October of 2007. For the next approximately 19 months, the employer continued to pay 100%, as they had at the time of injury, on the claimant's health insurance. A letter was then sent to the claimant's address that he was no longer at and had not been at for a while, that was a notice from a company that had only one page that said, we want to know who the people are who are your dependents. It didn't say there was any penalty to that. It didn't say there was any problem if he didn't give that information to them. And as you know from the briefs and from the testimony, that document was never received by the claimant. Whether the document was received or not is really not an issue, even though we've raised the issue of agency and we've raised the issue of the sufficiency of that notice, because the statute doesn't say anything about anybody notifying anyone of anything. All the statute says, clear as a bell.
But, counsel, let me ask you about that for a minute. I mean, the workers' comp statute wouldn't say anything about that, would it? Because this notice came from the health insurer. So why would there be anything in the workers' compensation statutes about this particular notice that was sent out?
Because if there was a requirement that there had to be notice of some kind before the employer had to stop paying, that would be an issue here, but it's not in the statute. The statute only says if your employer stops paying, whenever the employer stops paying, the benefit is to be calculated as part of the average weekly wage. It doesn't say when the employer stops paying after the third time or after the third attempt. For example, you have a person who works on a farm, on a ranch, and the employer provides health insurance, the employer provides room, the employer provides board, the employer provides a horse to ride, the employer provides a pickup truck to drive into town. You're hurt. The employer then says, well, I'm not going to do the pickup truck anymore. I'm not going to do the horse because you don't need them. Well, and by the way, I'm not going to pay your own board because I can't afford to do that anymore because you're not working. And then I'm not going to pay your health insurance. At what point, when the employer stops each one of these benefits, does the employee get to add to the average weekly wage?
But here we're just talking about health insurance, right?
We are just talking about health insurance, but the statute specifically states all other benefits. And it lists that within the statute itself. It doesn't just talk about health insurance.
But that's what we're concerned with.
That's what we're concerned with. But the reasoning applies no matter what. If what we're talking about is an employer can get to pick and choose or piecemeal stop someone's insurance, every employer will do what the employer has done in this case. Because you know, I mean, it's common knowledge that dependent health insurance or family health insurance or whatever you want to call it is much more expensive than health insurance for an individual. So it'd be real easy for every employer in every case to say, you know what, I'm not paying for dependents anymore. Because I know if I stop paying for your dependents, that's not going to be part of your weekly wage. I'll keep you on, and then I'll drop you off a month from now. And that will be considered part of your weekly wage.
Other than the non-published opinion in the Gonzalez case, which seems to go the other way from what you're arguing, are you aware of any published case in Colorado that addresses this specific issue that you're talking about?
No, and Gonzalez doesn't either, Your Honor, because there was a huge difference. In the Gonzalez case and, excuse me, let me tell you the other one, in Villa and Gonzalez, in both of those cases, the individuals had a portion of the insurance that they paid for. And in both of those cases, the individuals said, I can't afford to continue to pay my part of the health insurance anymore.
But, I mean, and this may get into the agency issue a little bit, but didn't you have that here also? Wasn't there a period of time where the employer was paying part of the premiums and the employee was supposedly paying the other part, but he never did because presumably he never got these bills and notices?
Right, and what was interesting about that was not what the claimant had at the time he was injured. The employer changed the rules.
Well, he didn't change the rules.
Well, he did change the rule in this sense, Your Honor. When you, again, the statute says at the time of injury. At the time of injury, the claimant had insurance that was 100% paid by his employer. The employer then dropped off the family members. Then the employer supposedly said, you're going to pay part, we're going to pay part. But that was never, as you said, that notice was never received by the claimant, yet he still had insurance coverage during the whole time. So the employer was obviously paying the whole premium. Somebody was paying it. The claimant did not lose his health insurance until the point in time the employer stopped paying. So what we had in the other cases was at the time of injury, those people had, like in most cases anymore, I mean, very few employers pay 100% of health insurance anymore. But in those particular cases, they had a situation where the employee paid part and the employer paid part. And in those two cases, the employee chose to stop paying, not the employer. The employer still would have paid if the employee had paid. In this case, that never happened. The claimant didn't pay anything any time for his health insurance. And just as the statute says, when the employer stops paying, it's in part of the average weekly wage. That's what happened in this case.
Ms. Rattani, and I forgive me if I'm a little confused. Is your argument that you look at what the wage was at the time of the injury as opposed to the time when the employer stops paying? I guess I had the impression, and I could be wrong, that you would do that calculation of the average weekly wage at the time, you know, the employer stops paying and the employee then needs to buy coverage for him or herself. Am I wrong about that?
It's what it costs the employee to obtain it at the time, Your Honor. So at the point in time when the employer stops paying.
Right.
So that's
the average weekly wage. So isn't that what we're looking at here? Don't we need to figure out what was in place at that time?
And we have that. It's
okay.
In our brief.
And then you're right. And I'm just trying to make sure I understand.
Okay.
So your argument, as I understand it, was that your client would have maintained dependent coverage had the client received the notice that the client was supposed to receive. Therefore, we should essentially assume that dependent coverage was in effect at that time.
No, because the Supreme Court has made it clear in the Ray case that the worker does not have to pick up coverage. Okay, and that's the case of...
I agree.
Okay. So all that we're saying is the employer can't have the benefit of saying, at the time you were injured, this was your benefit. Now I'm going to decide to start cutting your benefits, and when I cut the last one, that's going to be the one that we use to determine what the benefit was. I mean, to do that would be unconscionable. That's not the intent of the act.
Well,
the intent of the act is to make the claimant as whole as you can.
But would it be unconscionable in the example, I suppose, in the Gonzalez case where it was voluntary? Why is that unconscionable?
Because the statute, unfortunately, doesn't address when the employee stops doing it. It only addresses when the employer does. So the legislature decided in their wisdom that co-pays by employees were not the point in time when we could address that. It had to be when the employer stopped paying.
But absent the agency argument, and I realize that that's another question, I mean, why would it matter if it was voluntary or involuntary? I mean, absent agency, you could just assume here that the claimant decided not to keep that the dependent coverage, just like Gonzalez.
Except that in Gonzales, there was a copay by the employee. Here, there's no copay. The employee has never paid one penny of the health insurance. It's always been paid by the employer. And the statute...
Do we know that when the, when it just became a only partially paid by the employee, employer? I mean, isn't that essentially the same issue? He was apparently supposed to pay part of it, but he never knew about it?
No, because the employee in Gonzales knew they were supposed to pay it. It was what it was at the time they were injured. This is not what it was at the time the plaintiff was injured.
Let me ask you a question about the agency issue that's been bothering me a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And that's this whole preservation issue. Can you point me to any place in the record
mm-hmm.
where the agency issue that you're now articulating in this court and the agency issue as you articulated it before the panel, where you made that argument before the ALJ, where you used the word agency?
I didn't use the word agency, no, but I talked about in the hearing that the insurance company, or I should say the third party company, had notice of the fact that the claimant had changed addresses.
Which third party? For the health insurance?
REM. No, REM. The adjustment company.
Yes.
Okay.
I understand that. And the ALJ made a finding about that.
Right.
But was this agency argument made at all? And I guess if the answer is no, can you tell me, and I'll ask Employers' Council the same question, where in the world did the ALJ come up with this sentence where she talked about imputation? Where did she reach that?
Because of the arguments that we raised in our briefs when we were briefing it.
How do we know that? She didn't make any other findings that would go to this issue.
I can't read the ALJ's mind. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
We can't either. It's tough.
Yeah. But I mean, the bottom line is that the claimant had nowhere else to go. The claimant never knew about this insurance company. This was information that was totally unknown to us. We didn't even find out about it until discovery. We got some information. He didn't know he'd been cut off. He testified that he tried to find this out. You know, he called up his wife, went to go get health care, and found she didn't have insurance.
Well, is there anything in the record? I mean, he knew that he was insured. He knew that
right.
he had health insurance.
Right.
So was there anything in the record, anybody ask any questions about, well, did you receive this dependent audit notice in prior years? Is there anything like that?
No, because it never been brought up. It never been an issue.
Okay.
Anything else?
Counsel, I have a question. I couldn't tell from the record. Was this the first time that the average weekly wages had been determined, or was there, when he was first injured, was there another determination?
No, when a person is first injured, their average weekly wage is determined based on their earnings. We usually go back 12 to 26 weeks and figure that out.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I'll reserve my last 2 minutes.
Thank you, Counsel. You got a little over 2 minutes.
Good afternoon. The primary issue is whether, in fact, the cost...
I'm sorry, Counsel, could you just introduce yourself?
I'm sorry.
I assume it is Barrett.
Yes. I am Holly Barrett. I represent Family Dollar and Ace American Insurance Company. It's registration number 36711.
Thank you. Sorry.
The primary issue is whether or not the cost of continuing the claimant's health care benefits for his spouse and his dependent children should be added onto his average weekly wage.
Just about, let me ask you once there. Timer setting the clock. Hang on 1 second.
Sorry.
That's okay. We're getting it fixed. It's our fault. Sorry.
Okay, go ahead, Counsel.
Thank you. As counsel for the claimant stated, the section that applies in this case is section 840.201.19b. And it says that included in average weekly wage is the amount of an employee's cost of continuing the employer's group health insurance plan. As so long as the employer continues to pay any part of that benefit, it does not get added onto the claimant's average weekly wage. Once the employer stops paying any part of that benefit or stops paying that benefit, that's when you look and determine what that cost is so that it can be added on to the claimant's average weekly wage. As the cases that have interpreted this statute have reached, that applies once the termination of benefits has happened. So in this case, the employer stopped paying Mr. McGuire's health insurance benefits on April 16th, 2010. So if you look at what he was receiving on April 16th of 2010, he was the only person that was covered under that health insurance. So the only cost that should be added on to his average weekly wage is the $91.09, which was found by the administrative law judge in this case.
Counsel,
yes.
You'd admit though at the time of injury, he had coverage for dependent care as well as his own.
Yes.
Right.
Yes,
and
he did.
There's nothing in 19B itself that talks about calculating the average weekly wage.
No, it doesn't. But it says in 19B, upon termination of the continuation. And it's that termination that the courts looked at when they interpreted that statute. And it's when those benefits were terminated on April 16th of 2010, that you figure out how much he was receiving in health care benefits and what it would cost to replace that. And that's that $91.09. His dependents had been dropped a year earlier in May of 2009. When you look at when the benefits were terminated for him, it was $91.09. You look at April 16th, 2010, and that's what's added on to his average weekly wage. Courts have held firm that that is their interpretation of it, that the legislature knew that that was their interpretation of it when they came up with that provision, and that's the ALJ got it right in this case. And that's what you look at when you determine his increase in his average weekly wage.
Well, let me flesh this out a little bit. I'm going to come back eventually to this agency issue that you've raised and argues not preserved. If, I recognize that the panel said that they're basically agreeing with your argument that there's no imputation of the notice is not imputed. Let's take the opposite position. If it was, what would happen then? I mean, would we have to? I mean, so now the insurer had notice of the change address, but never sent notice to the claimant here. Will we have to reverse and remand for consideration of what would have happened? Because it seems like you'd have to take that into account. Mr. McGuire's position, basically, as I understand it, part of it, is that had I gotten notice, I would have re-upped my dependents coverage, and I would have been covered, and you would have included that.
We don't know that.
Right, and so that's a significant factual issue here. So, or at least I think it is, or maybe it is, about this question of agency. Right now, we have a finding from the ALJ that says, yes, the notice was, I don't say this backwards, was not imputed, I think is what it said, clear to the sky, it seems. And you say it was never even raised at all, right?
It wasn't. I think it's very clear in this case that Family Dollar and Ace American Insurance Company are two separately distinct entities in this case. They are not one and the same. There was never any evidence introduced at hearing that one had authority to act on behalf of the other. The claimant never raised the issue of agency in his application for hearing. It was never raised preliminarily at hearing when the judge asked what the issues were. It was never raised during closing argument at the hearing in that case. The first time that this agency argument came to light was in a brief.
It was in a ruling, right? I mean, the ALJ ruled on it. Now, if you're correct, and I'm not doubting you, that the issue is never raised at the hearing, and then the ALJ raises it on her own out of the clear blue sky, why doesn't Mr. McGuire get to raise that now? Never really had a chance to address it. Was surprised that the ALJ ruled, arguably.
We never had the chance to address that issue either. I mean, certain evidence would have been presented as to whether or not an agency relationship existed. And quite frankly, it doesn't matter. I mean, as Judge Lowe, did I pronounce that right? pointed out, in this case, it doesn't matter if the claimant decided to terminate those benefits on his own, if it was because he didn't receive this notice that the employer terminated those benefits. Quite frankly, it doesn't matter because what you look at is what he had on the date that those benefits were terminated.
You don't perceive a problem if the man never got notice at all that he had a right to re-up? I mean, they canceled it because he didn't re-up, but he never got notice that he was supposed to from his position.
Well, and that goes back to the agency issue. And I mean, the claimant admitted at hearing that he never told the employer. He has a duty and an obligation under the rules, workers' compensation rules of procedure, that he is to advise all of the parties of a change of address. And if you look back at those changes of address, he only sent it to the third party administrator and to the Division of Workers' Compensation. He didn't even send it to the insurance company at the time. He only sent it to the third party administrator.
Well, let me ask a question about this, just to make sure we have the facts. When you say third party administrator, you're talking about the third party administrator for the workers' comp insurer, correct?
That is correct, Judge.
Okay. Is the health insurance policy in the record? I mean, certainly somebody has obligations under a health insurance policy about change of address. Maybe it's both sides. But that's not in the record.
It is not in the record. And arguably, they would want notice as well. And the claimant should have provided notice to not only the insurer, but also the employer in this case. And had he done what he was required to do under the workers' compensation rules of procedure, we wouldn't be here, because he would have received these notices, because presumably they would have been sent to his correct address. And then maybe he would have paid those premiums, maybe he wouldn't have. But that's not why we're here today.
Is there anything in the record about whether the claimant did a change of address notification to the post office?
He did testify that he sent a change of address to the post office.
Okay, thank you.
I think the statute is clear. I think the interpretation is clear, that you look at what the cost for him would have been to continue his health care benefits at the time that those benefits were terminated. When they were terminated, he was the only one that was covered under that policy. Agency was never raised. I don't think it's properly before you. And I think the judge got it right, and I think she should be upheld.
Let me take a hypothetical then with you, counsel. Let's assume the facts that he asked for notices, he didn't get notices. I know these are not the facts. He specifically, he gave a change of address, and he was never notified about his right to re-up or renew the dependent coverage. Would you say on those facts, he's out of luck because all you do is you look at the day he was terminated and they stopped paying?
Your hypothetical is that he did receive these notices?
He gave the notice to the employer. They still didn't give him they didn't send the dependency, the form to him that would have allowed him to renew. On those facts, would you make the same argument you're making today, which is too bad, so sad, you're out of luck? I mean, your argument is pretty black and white.
He didn't
have dependent coverage on that day. His argument is, I would have re-upped if I got notice. I recognize there's an issue of agency. Well, I'm giving a different hypothetical. He sent his change of address. They didn't send him notice. On those facts, is he out of luck? Or what do you do? Do you understand the question you're
asking? I do, but I think it's factually distinct.
I agree. That's why it's a hypothetical.
Exactly.
So if I take that, I'm just trying to think of where's the line that you're drawing. So you're saying he's, because you're suggesting that we don't have to worry about the agency issue here. And I'm not so sure we can avoid it. That's what I'm asking this question. So just as a preliminary question, he gave notice, and the employer never sent him the form to renew. So he didn't have dependent coverage on the day they stopped paying and he had to pay. Is he out of luck at that point, or did we do something about the fact that he was never given the right to renew his dependent coverage?
In that case, you may do something because he wasn't given the right, but you still, under the statute, you look at what he was receiving and what it would cost him on the day that it was terminated.
I understand. So what would we do in my hypothetical? What would be the remedy if those were the facts?
I don't know.
Okay. So let's assume that you have to take into account, or at least arguably the ALJ and the panel have to take into account, that there was that he could have had dependent coverage had he been given a notice. In this case, if the argument of that agency was preserved, don't we have to consider it? In other words, we're in the same boat. Let's say it's preserved. Then his argument is, I gave the notice of my change of address, and you didn't send a notice to renew. I'm in the same boat as the hypothetical I gave you. That's potentially Mr. McGuire's argument.
If agency is something that's an issue here, the claimant has the burden in that case to prove that the insurer had the authority to act on behalf of the employer in this case. And there was no evidence that was presented whether or not that issue was preserved and properly before you. They had that burden, and they didn't present any evidence showing that they had the authority to act for the employer in this case.
So what then was the basis for the ALJ's ruling on this agency issue? No one presented any evidence. Where did it come from?
I don't know.
All right, so
I have the same response as counsel. I can't go into her mind. I don't know.
And I think that's absolutely fair. If the ALJ raised this issue on her own, does the claimant then get to argue it on appeal for the first time, because on the theory that the claimant never had even noticed the issue was even presented?
Well, no, because this is claimant's argument. The claimant is before you saying that he didn't receive notice. The claimant had every opportunity to argue that, yes, I provided notice to the employer or to the insurer in this case, which should have been imputed to the employer.
But the claimant didn't
argue that.
But the claimant didn't know it was an issue until the ALJ ruled.
Well, sure.
Just arguably.
Sure. I mean, it's their argument that they gave the notice and that notice was sufficient.
Well, then weren't they actually arguing agency?
Without saying that, I suppose they, in a sense, they are.
Well, if that's the case, then picking up on Judge Gabriel's question, I mean, if we were to agree with you on the statutory interpretation issue,
mm-hmm.
but we were to agree with claimant that the agency issue was properly raised and ruled on by the ALJ, then what's the remedy? What do we do?
You uphold the ALJ. Because if it was properly raised and properly before the ALJ found that there was no notice that was provided to the employer. It's not imputed to the employer when the claimant gives notice to the insurer. There was no evidence that they had the authority to act on behalf of the employer in this case because they didn't. The ALJ got it right. You can't impute that notice to the employer.
The question whether the notice to the workers' comp administrator, even if it's, number one, is imputed to the employer, and even if so, if it's imputed for purposes of the health coverage.
I don't understand your question, Judge.
I mean, if you're going to impute to employer, you've got to, if the claimant's going to win, you've got to impute it for everything. I mean, it may very well be that the workers' comp administrator was an agent in some respect for the employer in terms of administering
the insurance carrier.
For the workers' comp claim. I mean, that's who the notice went to, right? The notice of change of address went to the administrator for the workers' comp carrier.
Went to the Division of Workers' Compensation and to the third-party administrator for Ace American Insurance.
Which is the workers' comp carrier.
Yes.
Okay. Even if you assume that they were all acting as agents for the employer, and I recognize that you may not agree with that, but then how do you bring in the health insurer, which is the one that supposedly needed the address to send this audit form, having to do with health insurance, not having to do with workers' comp insurance?
That's another excellent question. I mean, had the employer known, presumably their insurance carrier would have known.
Why? How do we know that?
Because it's on the records of the employer, which is where I would think the health insurer for the employer would go to look to see where the claimant resided.
You would think, but we don't know any of
that. No, we don't. There's a lot that's missing.
Okay, thank you.
I have the same question that Judge Loeb asked counsel for the claimant, and that is, other than Gonzalez, the unpublished opinion, do you know of any published authority that supports your statutory interpretation?
No published authority, no.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Counsel, you've got 2 minutes and 3 seconds for whatever rebuttal you would like.
I'd like to bring the court's attention back to the statute, and I think this is critical. When you look at it talks about the term wages includes the amount of the employee's cost of continuing the employer's group health insurance plan and the reasonable value of board, rent, housing, and lodging we see from the employer. When you go to B, It says, if after the injury, the employer continues to pay any advantage or fringe benefit, specifically enumerated, that advantage or benefit shall not be included in the determination of the employee's wages so long as the employer continues to make payment. So we're back to any benefit the employer provides at the time the person's injured, that the employer stops paying for. At that point in time, that becomes part of the average weekly wage of the injured worker. I don't see any way to get around it with the way the statute's written. And whether there was notice to anyone, whether there was not notice to anyone, whether the employer told their health insurance company, who the claimant testified, he has no idea how he's supposed to contact them. It doesn't matter in many respects because of what the statute says. The statute says when the employer stops paying, it becomes part of the average weekly wage.
But you calculate it at the time the employer stops paying.
Right, so it should have been calculated for the dependent benefits when that stopped. That would have been added average weekly wage. And then when the employer stopped the benefit for the claimant, would have been added at that time.
Let me make sure. So your argument is when they start, you look at the time they stop paying any individual piece.
Right, because otherwise there's no other way to do it. You get the employer's position where they say, I'll stop paying all these benefits but leave this one little piece.
But why would we be calculating average weekly wage at each specific time? Don't we only care about it when the employer leaves? The employer stops paying and the employee has to pay?
Yes, and that's the point in time when the claimant would have had to pay. When the dependent coverage stopped, he would have had to pay.
I understand. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you
to both counsel for your arguments. The case will stand submitted. We'll issue an opinion in due course.